Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. This is Democracy Now!
Paul Robeson, who was a mentor and a man for whom I had enormous love and admiration, was the supreme example for me of how to use your life with dignity and with courage. Not bravado, but genuine social courage to put all that's on the line to come up against the forces of oppression.
The legendary actor, singer, and civil rights activist Harry Belafonte has died at the age of 96. We'll look at his remarkable life, including his pivotal role supporting Martin Luther King Jr. in the civil rights movement. He was also a fierce critic of U.S. foreign policy, including the invasion of Iraq.
We unilaterally walked into a country that had no threat to this country, and we invaded it. That's against the Constitution.
You call President Bush a terrorist?
I call President Bush a terrorist. I call those around him terrorists as well. Condoleezza Rice, Rumsfeld, Gonzalez in the Justice Department, and certainly Cheney.
Today, we'll hear Harry Belafonte in his own words, from his many appearances on Democracy Now!, all that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The bodies of at least 57 asylum seekers, including children, were found off the coast of western Libya Tuesday after two boats sank in the Mediterranean. The migrants were from Pakistan, Syria, Tunisia, and Egypt. Survivor Bassam Mahmoud, who is from Egypt, described the horrifying moments before one of the boats sank.
While the driver was turning the boat, some passengers started arguing with him. The weight was gathered at the front of the boat, not the back, so this made the boat sink. We started fighting for our lives, screaming and asking for help. It was an indescribable scene. I asked people from my country not to even think of trying this. Stay in your country.
Meanwhile, in Tunisia, the remains of at least 70 asylum seekers, mostly from Africa, have been recovered from the waters near the coastal city of Sfax. Local officials said morgues are nearly at capacity due to the rising number of migrant drownings as they attempt to reach Europe for safety. In Sudan, a fragile U.S.-brokered ceasefire between Sudan's warring military factions is in its second day as civilians on the ground report airstrikes are continuing, and the paramilitary rapid support forces say they've seized an oil refinery and power plant. Foreign countries continue to evacuate their citizens as fuel shortages, skyrocketing food prices, and a dearth of functioning health services are leading to a spiraling humanitarian crisis. The U.N. envoy to Sudan said neither side is willing to negotiate. This is UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
It is incumbent on Sudanese leaders to put the interests of their people front and center. This conflict will not and must not be resolved on the battlefield with the bodies of Sudan's people.
Harry Belafonte, the pioneering activist, singer, and actor, has died at the age of 96. Harry Belafonte was born in Harlem to Jamaican immigrant parents. He's credited with popularizing Caribbean music in the United States with his chart-topping 1956 album Calypso, which included the hits Jump in the Line, Jamaica Farewell, and Deo. His musical success led to multiple acting offers. He went on to star in dozens of films and TV shows, but his driving force was activism. He leveraged his successful entertainment career to shine a spotlight on civil rights and to fund movements like the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s Southern Christian Leadership Conference. He participated in the 1963 March on Washington. Belafonte famously said, quote, "I was an activist who became an artist. I was not an artist who became an activist." After headlines, we'll spend the hour with Harry Belafonte in his own words. He died of congestive heart failure this week at the age of 96. Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch sold a property he co-owned to the head of a major law firm that has since had 22 cases before the Supreme Court. The sale to Greenberg Traurig CEO Brian Duffy came just 9 days after the Trump-appointed Gorsuch was confirmed by the Senate in 2017. Previously, the property in rural Colorado had languished on the market for 2 years. Gorsuch reported the sale but left the box for the identity of the buyer on disclosure forms blank. The news, first reported by Politico Tuesday, comes in the wake of explosive revelations about fellow conservative Justice Clarence Thomas and his ties to GOP billionaire mega donor Harlan Crow, who lavished Thomas with luxury gifts for 2 decades and bought property from the Thomas family, which was never disclosed. Democrats are calling for investigations into both justices and for lawmakers to pass the Supreme Court ethics bill, which was reintroduced earlier this year. On Tuesday, Chief Justice John Roberts turned down a request from Judiciary Committee Chair Senator Dick Durbin to testify at an ethics hearing next week, offering instead a signed statement by the justices reaffirming a commitment to foundational ethics principles. Durbin deemed the statement inadequate and said, quote, "It's time for Congress to accept this responsibility to establish an enforceable code of ethics for the Supreme Court, the only agency of our government without it," he said. Graduate student teachers at the University of Michigan have been on strike for the past month, demanding fair wages, sexual harassment protections, and new provisions for campus safety, among other issues. In response to the strike, University of Michigan's president moved to withhold worker salaries and sent police officers to intimidate strikers, resulting in one graduate worker being attacked by an officer. This is Amir Fleischman of the Graduate Employees Organization.
Over the past 3 years, we've seen the gap between our salary and the cost of living triple. This is something that's being felt by workers all across the country, where corporate profits are at record highs, CEOs are getting humongous bonuses and even bigger salaries, while workers are being left to struggle and to take scraps. Workers at the University of Michigan are saying enough is enough, and that's why we're on strike.
In Washington state, Democratic Governor Jay Inslee signed into law a trio of bills Tuesday in an effort to prevent gun violence. The legislation bans the new sale of dozens of firearms, including some semi-automatic rifles, imposes a 10-day waiting period after purchasing a gun, and will allow for certain lawsuits against gun makers and dealers. This is Governor Inslee.
These weapons of war, of assault weapons, have no reason other than mass murder. Their only purpose is to kill humans as rapidly as possible in large numbers. And I will say this, AR-15s should not be idolized. They should be prohibited, and that's what we're doing today.
The White House praised Washington for the move, but gun groups have already launched legal challenges to the measures, claiming a violation of the constitutional right to bear arms. Somali authorities say U.S.-backed forces killed at least 18 al-Shabaab militants over the weekend. 3 civilians are also reported to have been killed in the fighting. There are roughly 500 U.S. troops in Somalia. In Washington, D.C., Republican Congressmember Matt Gaetz has been pushing a war powers resolution to remove the troops. In Iran, 2 renowned actresses have been criminally charged for not wearing a hijab. Karyoun Riahi and Panteha Bahram could face prison time, accused of removing their headscarves in public and posting photos on social media. This comes as the Iranian government has intensified the enforcement of its strict dress code. Authorities are now planning to prosecute people who encourage women to remove their headscarves, while surveillance cameras have been installed in public places to catch anyone violating the hijab mandate.
This harsh and rude response will definitely either make things worse or will not lead anywhere.
The Texas Department of Agriculture issued a memo forcing its employees to wear clothing that's consistent with their so-called biological gender. The move is the latest attack on the rights of transgender people in Texas. Agriculture Commissioner Sid Miller is a Republican and loyal supporter of former President Trump. And in related news in Florida, hundreds of drag performers and supporters marched to the state capitol in Tallahassee Tuesday, protesting a new bill that bans children from attending, quote, adult live performances, unquote, which LGBTQ advocates say targets drag shows. This is one of the demonstrators.
Drag is not a crime. It's an art form, and it
it gives us a community that we didn't previously have, and that's what today is about. Today is about community. Today is about showing the Florida legislature that no matter what they do, no matter how hard they try, our community, LGBTQ, trans, drag, our community will always exist, and we will always continue to thrive.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we remember the life of legendary singer, actor, civil rights leader Harry Belafonte, who died Tuesday at the age of 96. Stay with us.
I think of Andy in the cold, wet clay. Three are on my mind, with his comrades down beside him on that brutal day. Those three are on my mind. There lies young James in his final pain. Can you see those three again? Those three are on my mind. I see dark-eyed Michael with his dark-eyed bride.
Three Are on My Mind, performed by Harry Belafonte. The song was about the slain civil rights activists Michael Schwerner, James Cheney, and Andrew Goodman, who were killed in Mississippi in 1964. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, we spend the hour remembering the remarkable life of Harry Belafonte. The pioneering actor, singer, civil rights activist died at his home on Tuesday in New York at the age of 96 from congestive heart failure. The son of Jamaican immigrants, Belafonte grew up in Harlem and Jamaica. In the 1950s, he spearheaded the calypso craze, became the first artist in recording history with a million-selling album. He was also the first African-American actor to win an Emmy. Along with his rise to worldwide stardom, Belafonte became deeply involved in the civil rights movement. One of Dr. Martin Luther King's closest confidants, he sent money to bail King out of the Birmingham City Jail and raised thousands of dollars to release other imprisoned protesters. He financed the Freedom Ride, supported voter registration drives, and helped to organize the March on Washington in 1963. Harry Belafonte remained deeply involved in political struggles at home and abroad. A longtime critic of U.S. foreign policy, called for an end to the embargo against Cuba, opposed policies of war and global oppression. After years of supporting the anti-apartheid movement, Belafonte hosted former South African President Nelson Mandela on his triumphant visit to the United States after his release from prison in South Africa. Harry Belafonte also spoke out against the U.S. invasion of Iraq and once called President George W. Bush the, quote, greatest terrorist in the world. Harry Belafonte appeared on Democracy Now! Numerous times. In 2011, I spoke to him at the Sundance Film Festival, where a documentary about his life titled Sing Your Song premiered. The film was co-produced by Harry Belafonte's daughter, Gina. This is a part of the film's trailer.
Here is one of the greatest artists of the world, Harry Belafonte.
Dale, Dale, he like come and he wander.
One day, Paul Robeson came to see me and simply said, get them to sing your song and they'll want to know who you are.
Even in that grainy black and white early TV, his personality came out.
When Harry Belafonte went on the show with Petula Clark, they touched.
People were like, oh my God. whatever you're capable of doing as artists to help propagandize the civil rights revolution.
Out of that came the true artistry of Harry Belafonte.
There's a lot of people out here who are really pissed off.
Harry gave us a piece of his fire. It gave us all strength.
We are angry, we're upset.
Harry motivated Martin because here's a man who didn't have to get involved and who did.
We look around for some comfort and we don't find any.
I remember once when you said, from the time I get up, the time I go to sleep, I seek out the injustices done to humankind.
What do we want?
He was always like that. He was always, let's do something.
Harry did this over and over and over and over again.
He took all our struggles and made them his own.
The trailer for the documentary Sing Your Song about the life of Harry Belafonte, who's died at the age of 96. The film premiered at the 2011 Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah, where I interviewed Harry. I asked him to talk about his first memories of being politically active.
I'm not quite sure precisely when social and political activism became a visible brand of my DNA. But it seems to me that I was born into it. It is hard to be born into the experience in the world of poverty and not develop some instinct for survival and resistance to those things that oppress you. My mother was a feisty lady, although she had never gotten into a place of formal education. She came here and had to learn skills. She became a seamstress. She became an expert cook. She worked at odds and ends and jobs. She never resisted the opportunity to fight oppression, especially segregation and all the things that plagued people who were immigrants. In her resistance, she counseled us constantly.
Now, professionally, you started more acting before you really started professionally singing. Is that right?
Well, acting was the complete key, was the main key to my getting involved in this play that we did of Steinbeck's Of Mice and Men. The director had created a character in the play who would become the balladeer. He would be a force. The director moved throughout the play to in the changing of sets, changing of cues, lighting cues, changing of mood. And this character would immerse from the darkness of the corners of the stage and sing the songs of the day for those migrant workers coming from Southwest America. And most of the songs that I had to sing were the songs that had been written by Hughie Ledbetter and by Woody Guthrie. As a matter of fact, I opened the play with a Woody Guthrie song. Anyway, let me jump to the quick of this. It was approaching the material as an actor, because the director spent a lot of time on what the balladeer would do, how he would be positioned, and how he would be positioned, what the intensity of the moment of singing the song would mean to the development of the play, of the scene. And in that context, I approached music as a tool. Well, that was really about social information. It wasn't just harmony and chords and notes and melody, all that was obvious, but it was the content and the power of song. And having been heard in that play, in that context, I was offered a job to become a singer. And since I couldn't find other work, being a singer was a good challenge. So I put a repertoire together, walked into a nightclub called the Royal Roost, met guys like Charlie Parker, Miles Davis, and Max Roach.
They were your backup band?
My first backup band were those guys. And it just launched me into a world from which I have never looked back.
One of the incredible stories told in Sing Your Song is your traveling through the South and trying to sing your song. Talk about that experience.
Paul Robeson, who was a mentor, and a man for whom I had enormous love and admiration, was the supreme example for me of how to use your life with dignity and with courage. Not bravado, but genuine social courage to put all that's on the line to come up against the forces of oppression who controlled so much of what you could or could not do as an artist, and to defy that fact and go after the larger goal of changing up the faces of oppression inspired me. And he went everywhere there was the opportunity to be heard, whether it was going into Spain to sing during the great Spanish Revolutionary War in the 30s, whether it was going to England. He went, he worked with the Welsh miners. As a matter of fact, his whole engagement politically had been stimulated by what happened when he met the Welsh miners, and he sang with them, and he went into their world. But when I watched what he did and how many places he went for inspiration, and mostly places where there was oppression, I felt those were the places in which I would be most nourished with what I should be doing with my own art and with my own platform. And certainly going into the south of the United States, listening to the voices of rural black America, listening to the voices of those who sang out against the Ku Klux Klan and out against segregation, and women who were the most oppressed of all, coming, rising to the occasion to protest against their conditions, became the arena in where my first songs were to emerge. And in that context, going in the south was for me not to exploit commercially. That didn't come until later. And but to be, to find the resources to nourish my own creativity.
So there you were, the star on the stage, but you couldn't go in the front door. Describe that experience.
When I went to the South on a professional basis, I had already arrived at a place where there was some visibility. I was going with artists who were quite well known. Margin Gower Champion, a play called Three for the Night. We, in many of the places we booked throughout the universities of America, a lot of the places we went to the universities in the South, like Chapel Hill and the University of Texas. And in going to those places, we thought we were going not so much for the commercial reward of it, that's how we made our living, but to get the young people and to get our works before them. And in the places that we went, some of the auditoriums were public institutions. And when I got to some of these places, not only did they not want to let me in the theater, they didn't want to let me in the places in which we were booked to stay overnight. There were many instances where, by law, no black person could stay in this hotel. Or by law, no black person could be sitting at a table with a white member of the cast, I mean, white woman member of the cast, and not be sitting in the threat of incarceration and the law coming down on you, because these were the tenets of the law. This wasn't just something that was capricious. It was written. It was the legislation of the state, and we had to come up against that. And the battle was consistent. And even in the North, places like the Waldorf Astoria and the Palmer House in Chicago and these mighty institutions of culture that had strict race laws. And in accepting employment to go in these places, rigidly placed in my contract was the requirement that those laws and those rules be suspended and not be evoked during the time of my appearance.
Harry Belafonte, when did you first meet Dr. Martin Luther King?
It was right after Birmingham. I'm sorry, Montgomery. Right after the Montgomery bus boycott had taken hold, and the Montgomery Bus Boycott Association, the Montgomery Improvement Association. And we'd all heard about this young minister, and certainly we all heard of Rosa Parks. And I got a call. And before the strike had been settled, even, they had not expected it to run so long.
So this was in 1956?
1956. Dr. King called, and he was coming to New York to speak at the Abyssinia Baptist Church. There was, at that time, the head pastor was Adam Clayton Powell, who was in our Congress. and he was going to give a lecture to people from the ecumenical community. And he said, I'm coming to New York, and I'd love to have an opportunity to meet you. And I'd like to give you an idea of what it is that I do. And I was absolutely fascinated that he called, and I wanted very much to meet him. So I went up to the church to hear him speak. And at the end of his lecture, he would retire to the basement. And for what he said would just be a few minutes, almost at the end of 4 hours, we exchanged thoughts and feelings and passions. And at the end of that meeting, I knew that I would be in his service and focus on the cause of the desegregation movement, the right to vote, and all that he stood for. Although we understood how perilous the journey would be, we were not quite prepared for all that we had to confront. And I think it was the most important time in my life.
I wanted to go to a clip from Sing Your Song of Dr. Martin Luther King.
Dr. King, do you fear for your life?
I'm more concerned about doing a good job, doing something for humanity and what I consider the will of God, than about longevity. Ultimately, it isn't so important how long you live. The important thing is how well you live.
I have some very sad news for all of you, and I think sad news for all of our fellow citizens and people who love peace all over the world. And that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis.
That was Dr. Martin Luther King, and that clip is from the film about Harry Belafonte's life, about the history of the 20th century and coming into the 21st, called Sing Your Song. Harry, that relationship you had with Dr. King that went on for more than a decade until his assassination, how often did you speak?
I would say easily we spoke every day. Obviously, we missed some days or some weekends, but the line was constantly filled with thoughts and ideas and challenge and up-to-date decisions that were being made by a team of people who were always brought together when there was the moment to escalate what we were doing or to be cautious about where we were going, and also trying to broaden the base of our political relationships. So much of what our mission was doing was very dependent on our relationship with the federal government, with the institutions of justice, because our plea was on a constitutional basis. The Constitution of the United States of America is being grossly violated by all the things that black people are experiencing. And if you don't have the instruments of government and the federal government on your side, including the courts, then you really can't do very much, because all the laws that bound us to such cruel experience were state laws, and there was no way to appeal the injustice within the state structure. So we had to find ways in which to broaden our campaign to include a national movement, and it becoming a national movement, to entice federal intervention.
Do you know how many of those hundreds of conversations were recorded by the FBI?
I think my safest bet would be all of them. I don't know when it would have started, but...
Have you gotten transcripts of those conversations?
Yes, transcripts. I've gotten some stuff from the Freedom of Information Act. What's very important